This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, this is Jen. I'm the technical director of On the Media. We engineers are wired differently from the rest of the team. While the producers and the hosts are working on the content, we are obsessing over the mechanics of getting this week's show to you. You know, I think of it like an if-then switch, and lately, there have been nothing but gigantic ifs and thens. If I lose connection to Brooke or Bob, then how do I get the interview recorded? If we don't have our normal setup, then how do I make everything sound good? If we can't get into the studio, then how do I get the show out? There are so many if-thens, and they keep me up at night. The big one is if we don't have listener support, then how do we keep the lights on? I imagine these days you are all thinking like engineers with your own if-thens. And if you aren't able to support us right now, then please know we understand. But if you are at all able to, then now is the time. Go to onthemedia.org to donate or text OTM to 70101. Thank you so much.
Today, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments about President Trump's tax returns, and we, the public, got to listen in simply by going online.
Pardon, sir. Not presidential finances. We're asking for his personal returns before he became president. Those are very different things.
The fact that what I hold today will also apply to a future Senator McCarthy asking a future Franklin Roosevelt or Harry Truman exactly the same questions, that bothers me.
But the aura of this case is really sauce for the goose that served the gander as well.
The Supreme Court has resisted live streaming oral arguments for years. Previously, members of the public could only witness the proceedings live if they queued up outside the court to get one of the 50 tickets guaranteed to the public.
People are lining up over here just to get a seat inside the courtroom tomorrow morning to see these justices announce this historic ruling.
Often people waited outside overnight in the elements with no public toilet for blocks. But amid the COVID-19 pandemic, the court is finally adapting. Oral arguments are now conducted via a conference call, and the world can listen in by going online. No queuing required. So far, the online Supreme Court seems to be working pretty well. A couple of hiccups aside, 2 days in a row, Justice Sonia Sotomayor forgot to unmute herself.
Justice Sotomayor? I am sorry, Chief. Did it again.
And the next day,
the subject matter of the call ranges to the topics, then the call is
a justice of the Supreme Court was caught with his or her pants down. You ask for increased transparency, you get increased transparency. Nonetheless, the benefits of public access dictated at last by global crisis have been widely heralded as a major step forward for our system of justice, as has expanded technology in lower courts around the country. But advance can be in the eye of the beholder. Douglas Keith is counsel in the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University Law School. Doug, welcome to OTM.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with the High Court, now suddenly dragged kicking and screaming into the 21st century. The state of the art before this month was what?
Before this, the Supreme Court would generally release audio of oral arguments at the end of the week. And audio, on rare occasions, would come out on the same day, just for the major cases, Bush v. Gore, landmark cases about affirmative action. It was fairly rare. But generally, the public had to wait till the end of the week to hear the justices themselves speak about a case.
So transparent, but with a time delay.
Yes, that's right.
the audio streaming seems to be a vast improvement, certainly in immediate public access to the process. Immediacy is an unalloyed good, right? At least in this respect, immediacy thumbs up.
In this respect, this is working well, and it's giving the public new ways to understand its justice system, to understand some of its most important institutions. What the court is doing is allowing the public to more effectively think about a case, engage in the issues around a case. The public can listen themselves the day of. People are live blogging the arguments. There are many more ways that the public can engage around a case when it's actually being discussed.
Another big benefit, it seems to me, in a country that, at least theoretically, is built upon rule of law, the practical and symbolic value of continuity in the midst of a catastrophe. So thumbs up on those counts, but not without some sacrifice. The antiquated processes of, 2019 did confer some advantages, no?
Some court watchers have noted the way that oral arguments take place has also changed as the technology has changed. When all the parties were previously in the courtroom, you'd have justices jumping in, adding on to one another's questions, following up lines of questioning. And now the court is going justice by justice, if anything, just to avoid the mayhem of a poorly managed conference call. You also have justices speaking who normally would not. Justice Thomas has been asking a number of questions in these remote oral arguments when previously he was silent. And so the dynamic of these arguments have changed. I think it's not quite clear yet whether it's overall for the better or for the worse.
If the Supreme Court is a little late to the online party, other courts in other jurisdictions haven't been. What is the cost of delayed justice for the many?
The costs of courts not being able to operate in this moment at all would have been immense. There are survivors of domestic violence who've sought orders of protection in this time and have been able to get the protection of the court through video proceedings. There are people who have been illegally locked out of their homes by landlords, even in places where there are eviction moratoriums in place, that have been able to get the support of the court via virtual proceedings.
Again, there are obvious opportunities and benefits here, but also some reasons for caution. For example, the notion that this cold filter of technology, say live streaming, that could denude the process of the human element, you know, the flesh and blood adversaries making their case face to face, will we miss that?
Yes, we view people differently when they appear by video. Studies with mock jurors finding that jurors viewed people as less credible when they appeared by video than when they appeared in person. At this point, 1 in 6 immigration proceedings takes place by video already. That's pre-pandemic. So one study by Professor Eagley out of UCLA found that people in removal proceedings are more likely to be deported if they're required to appear by video than if they appear in person. Another study found that people who were seeking asylum were twice as likely to win their asylum claims if they appeared in person than if they appeared by video. In the criminal context, in Chicago, for the proceedings that went to video, the bail was set at a 50% higher level than it was for the proceedings that continued to take place in person. So while the research is limited, we know that these video proceedings can harm defendants.
And why? What would be happening through live streaming, for example, that would so influence outcomes?
So the research hasn't arrived at any one answer. In fact, there are a number of possible explanations for this. First, it's important to note that there are different levels of access to internet or high-quality internet or internet that is accessible by a computer rather than by a phone. There's differences in levels of access by income, by age, by race, by geography. Once you're in the courtroom, even if you have access to these technologies, there's a dramatic shift in the attorney-client relationship. You know, it's harder for an attorney and a client to strategize before a hearing, to share information in the middle of a hearing, to constantly inform each other while a procedure is ongoing in such a way that helps the client's chances of succeeding.
I'm anticipating a frustration dream where I am in court charged with a crime and I'm having my trial by Zoom and watching my battery life on my smartphone just dissipate before my eyes, I wake up screaming.
I think it was in March, an immigration judge was hearing a case involving seven detained children and ultimately had to postpone the proceeding because the technology was just so problematic. An asylum hearing that was taking place on the same technological platform, the audio kept bleeding in to the other proceeding about whether these children would be able to remain in the country. Technology glitches are a real obstacle to fairness and to courts being able to really rely on these technologies.
For at least 30 years, there's been controversy about televised judicial proceedings, partly based on the premise that judges will go all Judge Ito and start performing instead of adjudicating. But there's one study that shows that judges in streamed court proceedings aren't changing their stripes, but the defendants are nonetheless at a disadvantage. So it's not the judge, it's the everything else.
It may not just be the ultimate decision that is impacted. It could be every step along the way. At least one study out of UCLA found that what seemed to be changing the outcomes was a general disengagement with the legal process by the person appearing by video, a general feeling that the procedure was unfair or not as real as one that you were attending in person, which led people to seek representation less often, to seek certain forms of protections from the court less often, even if they were entitled to those protections.
In this country, we cherish access for criminal defendants, for litigants to the justice process. But what you're saying suggests that there are degrees of access. I don't know if you'll like this analogy, but you know, you can have the platinum healthcare plan or you can have the HMO. Are we seeing the build out of a vast system of judicial HMOs?
There's a real risk of creating new tiers of a justice system. You will have defendants represented by high-resourced law firms who are capable of providing an environment and set of technology that will make sure that they appear in the best possible light. And then you will have individuals who don't have access to those resources and are left trying to attend a court proceeding by the Zoom app on their phone and may be left feeling differently about the justice system, may be viewed differently by the people on the other end of the video conference.
Throughout the pandemic, we've learned that throughout the economy and the culture, things that we perceived as immutable turn out to be mutable indeed, like going to work in an office or going to school in a school. And undoubtedly, some draconian changes will become the new normal. I wonder about this one. There are obvious advantages in cost and security and courtroom order. Hell, parking. So let's assume, Doug, that e-court to some significant degree is here to stay. How do we make sure that technology serves justice and not erodes it?
It seems highly likely that some increased reliance on virtual courts will be here for at least the medium term, if not the long term. So the question is not, should courts stop with these procedures? It's how do they mitigate the harm that the research shows may in fact exist around these proceedings? So foremost, what courts can do in this moment is listen to the people who are going to be most impacted if this transition to virtual proceedings does not go well. Already, these advocates are putting forth some requests of court systems. You know, there's been a demand for only holding proceedings virtually to which parties consent. If the parties agree to hold it virtually, then it can move forward. But otherwise, the court should really hold off, at least for now. Advocates have said that there should be more opportunities for attorney-client communication, both on the day of proceedings and in between hearings, to make up for that lost communication inside the courtroom. Courts inevitably, if they're going to turn this way, are going to need more tech support to make sure that the quality of technology that's needed to ensure fairness exists.
Doug, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Douglas Keith is counsel in the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University Law School. Allowing Supreme Court proceedings to be broadcast live to the public might never have happened if it weren't for the pandemic. In fact, some of the justices were so vehemently against it that a few years back, former OTM producer Jesse Brenneman composed a song all about the fight to get cameras in the courtroom.
Television in court. I was for it when I first joined the court and switched and remain on that side of it. I do not believe the purpose would be to educate the American people.
It will alter the way in which we hear our cases, the way in which we talk to counsel, the way in which we use that precious hour. Please don't introduce into the dynamic the temptation, the insidious temptation to think that one of my colleagues is trying to get a soundbite for the television. We don't want that. Please, Senator, we don't want that. Please don't introduce the temptation, the insidious temptation.
Television in the court.
The way in which we use that precious, precious hour.
Television in the court.
We'll have to talk together.
We don't want that.
Television in the court.
I think it would be a terrific thing.
Please don't introduce the insidious temptation. Trying to get a soundbite for the television.
Could you argue the opposite position?
I could make a lot of points about educating the public.
If the American people watched our proceeding gavel to gavel, they would never again ask, Jessica Lee, why do you have to be a lawyer to be on the Supreme Court?
When you see what happens, it's an inspiring sight. All nine justices, so prepared, so smart, so thorough, really seeing government at work.
1 million people could have seen that oral argument. That would be wonderful.
I have had positive experiences with cameras.
It seems somewhat perverse to exclude the television.
I don't see any problem with having proceedings televised.
So it sounds like you all changed your minds.
The day you see a camera coming into our courtroom, it's going to roll over my dead body.
Regular appearances on TV would mean significant changes in the way my colleagues could conduct their lives. My anonymity is already gone.
Most of the American people would see 15-second takeouts, and those takeouts would not be characteristic of what we do. They would be uncharacteristic.
Yeah, now what we see is an article in a newspaper that's out of context.
That's fine. People read that and they say, well, it's an article in a newspaper. But somehow when you see it live, an excerpt live.
This has been an On the Media podcast extra. Don't miss this week's big show. And in the meantime, if you want a lot of stuff that's different than our shows, subscribe to the On the Media newsletter at onthemedia.org/newsletter.
It means I'd have to get my hair done more often, Senator Spector.
Oh. Let me commend you on that last comment.